There's a space for you in the barn. I'll have some food sent down for lunch. We'll call you at dinner. Cord remained still for a moment. Then he spat to one side and nodded toward his sons. Arik collected the gasping Bitan, hauling him to his feet, and the three of them walked toward the wide doors of the roomy stone barn. Only as they left did the ground quiver beneath Isana's bare foot and let her go. She closed her eyes, and the terror she'd been holding back, her own, flooded out and over her. She started shaking, but she shook her head to herself, firmly. Not in front of everyone. She opened her eyes and looked around the courtyard full of people. Well, she asked them. There is a lot of work to do before the feast comes sundown. I can't do everything around here by myself. Get to it. People moved at her words, started talking again amongst themselves. Some of them shot her looks of mixed respect, admiration, and fear. Isana felt that last, like frozen cockle burrs rolling over her skin. Her own folk, people she'd lived and worked with for years, afraid of her. She lifted a hand as tears blurred at her eyes, but that was one of the first tricks a watercrafter learned. She willed them away from her eyes, and they simply did not fall. The confrontation with its rampant tension and potential for murderous violence had shaken her more than anything in years. Isana drew in a careful breath and walked toward the kitchens. Her legs kept her steady at least, though the weariness now crawling over her was nearly too much to bear. Her head ached with the efforts of the morning, with the pressure of all that watercrafting. Fade came shuffling out of the smithy as she passed it. He moved with an odd little drag of one foot. Not a large man. He had been badly burned when he had been branded with a coward's mark, disfiguring the left half of his face, though that had been years ago. His hair, nearly black, had grown out long and curling to partially conceal it, and the scar tracing over his scalp, presumably a head wound, also suffered in battle. The slave offered her a witless smile and a tin cup of water, holding it up to her along with a fairly clean cloth, far different from his own sweaty rags and burn-scarred leather apron. "Thank you, Fade," Isana said. She accepted both and took a drink. "I need you to keep an eye on Cord. I want you to let me know if he or his sons leave the barn. All right?" Fade nodded rapidly, his hair flopping. A bit of drool flicked off his half-open mouth.
"Eye on Cord," he repeated. "Barn."
He frowned, staring into space for a long moment, and then pointed a finger at her.
"What better?"
She shook her head. "I'm too tired. Just tell me if they leave, all right?"
"Leave,"
Fade repeated. He mopped at his drool with one sleeve.
"Tell."
"That's right," she said, and gave him a weary smile. "Thank you, Fade." Fade made a hooting sound of pleasure and smiled.
"Welcome."
"Fade, you'd better not go into the barn. The cord holders are there, and I get the feeling they'd not be kind to you."
The
slave said.
"Watch, barn, tell."
He turned at once and shuffled off quickly, despite the drag of his foot. Isana put old Bitter in charge of the kitchens and returned to her room. She sat down on her bed, her hands folded on her lap. Her stomach fluttered nervously, but she forced herself to take deep breaths to stay calm. She had headed off the most immediate trouble, and Fade, despite his lack of skilled speech and his simple manner, was reliable. He would warn her if something else came up in the meantime. She worried about Tavi, now more than any time she could remember. He was safe enough with Bernard to look after him, but her instincts would not relent. The pine hollows were the most dangerous stretch of land in the valley, but to her weary senses, the danger seemed deeper than that and more threatening. There was something heavy and foreboding in the air of the valley, a gathering of forces that made the storm brewing over Garados look weak and tiny by comparison. Isana lay down on her bed. "Please," she whispered, exhausted.
"Great Furies, please keep him safe."
Chapter 5. Tavi picked up Dodger's trail within an hour, but from there it wasn't so easy. Tavi tailed the flock throughout the morning and into the early afternoon, stopping only to drink from an icy brook and to eat some cheese and salt mutton his uncle had brought with him. By then, Tavi knew that Dodger was living up to his name and leading them on a merry chase, looping back and forth through the barrens. Though gloomy Gyarados grew ever taller and darker with storm clouds, Tavi ignored the glowering presence of the mountain and kept his focus on his work. Noon was well past when he finally caught up to the wily ram and his flock. He heard the sheep before he saw them. One of the ewes let out plaintive bleats. He looked back over his shoulder to where his uncle followed several dozen strides behind him and waved a hand to let Bernard know he'd found them. He couldn't keep the grin off his face, and his uncle answered Tavi's smile with his own. Dodger had led the flock into a dense thicket of brambles and thorns nearly as tall as Tavi himself and 100 feet deep. Tavi spotted Dodger's curling horns and approached the old ram carefully, talking as he always did. Dodger snorted and pawed at the earth with his front hooves, shaking his curling horns threateningly. Tavi frowned at the ram and approached him more slowly. Dodger himself weighed better than a quarter ton, and the tough breed of mountain sheep the frontier folk of Alera favored, sheep big enough and strong enough to defend themselves against Thanodonts and worse, could become aggressive when threatened. Careless shepherds had been killed by their overexcited charges. A sharp, sweet smell made Tavi stop in his tracks. He recognized the scent of slaughtered sheep, of offal and blood. Something was very wrong. Tavi approached more slowly, eyes carefully sweeping around. He found the first dead sheep, one of the lambs, several yards short of the brambles. He knelt down and studied the remains, searching for clues as to what had killed the animal. It hadn't been slives. Slives could kill young sheep, even adults, if they had numbers enough. But the poisonous lizards swarmed over corpses and ravaged them into strips of flesh and bared bones. The lamb was dead, but it only showed a single wound, a massive, clean cut that had nearly severed the lamb's head from its neck. A Thanodont's talons might have been capable of inflicting such a wound, but when one of the great mountain beasts took a kill, it either devoured it on the spot or else dragged it off to a secluded lair to feed. Wolves, even the great wolves of the savage, barbarian-infested wilds east of the Calderon Valley, could not have struck and killed so cleanly. And besides, any predator would have begun to devour the lamb. Beasts did not kill for sport. The ground around the lamb was grossly disturbed. Tavi checked around quickly for tracks, but he found only the hoof marks of the sheep, and then some marks he was not familiar with, and could not even be sure were tracks. One partially disturbed track may have been the outline of a human heel, but it could as easily have been the result of a round stone being rolled out of its place. Tavi rose, puzzled, and found two more corpses lying on the ground between the first lamb and Dodger's refuge in the thicket. Another lamb and a ewe, both dead of similar massive, clean wounds. A powerful fury might have been capable of causing those wounds, but furies rarely attacked animals without being compelled to do so by their crafter. If an animal had not done the killings, only a man could have. He would need a viciously sharp blade, a long hunting knife or a sword, and might need fury-enhanced strength to help as well. But the frontier valley rarely had visitors, and none of the hold folk wandered through the pine barrens. Gyarados's looming presence made the land for miles about it seem heavy with apprehension, and it was nearly impossible to get a good night's sleep so near the old mountain. Tavi looked up and frowned at Dodger, who remained in the entrance to the thicket, horns presented in warning, and Tavi suddenly felt afraid. What could have struck down those sheep that way?
"Uncle,"
Tavi called. His voice cracked a little. Something is wrong. Bernard approached, frowning, his eyes taking in Dodger and the flock, then the dead sheep upon the ground. Tavi watched his uncle take it in, and then Bernard's eyes widened. He rose and drew the short, heavy sword of the Legionare from his belt.
Tavi, come over to me.
What? Bernard's voice took on a sharp edge of anger and command that Tavi had never heard in Uncle before.
Now!
Tavi's heart began to pound in his chest, and he obeyed.
What about the flock?
Forget them, Bernard said, his voice crisp and cold. We're leaving.
But we'll lose the sheep. We can't just leave them here.
Bernard passed the sword to Tavi, scanning slowly around them, and fitted an arrow to the string of his bow.
Keep the point low. Put your other hand on the small of my back and leave it there.
Tavi's fear rose sharply, but he forced it away and obeyed his uncle.
What's wrong? Why are we leaving?
Because we want to get out of the barrens alive.
Bernard started pacing silently away from the thicket, his face set in concentration.
Alive? Uncle, what could...
Bernard tensed abruptly and spun to one side, lifting his bow. Tavi turned with him and saw a flash of motion beyond a small stand of young trees before them.
What is...
There was a hissing wail from their opposite side. Tavi whipped his head around, but his uncle was slower, spinning his entire body with his bow at arm's length, an arrow drawn back to his cheek. Tavi could do little but watch their attacker come. It looked like a bird. If a bird could be 8 feet tall and mounted on a pair of long, powerful legs, thicker and stronger looking than a racing horse's, and tipped with wicked claws. Its head sat on the end of a long, powerful, flexible neck and sported a hawk's beak, enlarged many times, sharp-looking and viciously hooked. Its feathers were coloured in all dark browns and blacks, though its eyes were a brilliant shade of gold. The bird bounded forward, taking a pair of steps and leaping into the air, both claws coming forward to rake, while it beat at the air with ridiculously undersized wings. Tavi felt his uncle shove at him with his hip as he turned and fell away and to one side, Bernard between him and the oncoming horror. Bernard loosed his arrow without sighting. The arrow flew, struck at a poor angle, and glanced off the thing's feathers, skittering away in a blur of black and green fletching. The beast landed on Bernard, its claws raking, its vicious beak whipping forward and down toward him. When hot droplets of his uncle's blood struck his face, Tavi began to scream. The bird thing's talons lashed out, raking and tearing. One of them ripped through Uncle Bernard's tough leather breeches at the thigh. Blood welled and flowed. Another talon tore through his hair down toward his throat, but Bernard raised his arm, sliding the lethal claws away on the wood of the bow. The creature's vicious beak darted down at him, but again Bernard parried the attack away. The great bird's beak darted to one side and snapped the heavy wood of the bow like a dry twig. It gave way with a sharp detonation as the heavy tension of the string was released. Tavi raised the sword and started toward his uncle, screaming, but it didn't sound like his own voice. It was too high, too thin, and too terrified to be his voice. The bird's head swiveled toward him, golden eyes focusing on him with a terrible, mindless intensity.
"Brutus!" shouted Uncle Bernard as the bird's attention focused on Tavi. "Take him!"
The earth at the bird's feet shuddered and then ripped itself upward as Brutus came to Bernard's call. A thin layer of soil peeled back away from raw stone. Brutus surged up from the earth like a hound emerging from boiling surf, head and shoulders of a great hunting dog made of soil and stone. The fury's eyes glowed green as emeralds and shone with a faintly luminous light. Brutus planted his front paws on the ground, hauling his pony-sized body forward, and stone jaws closed on the thigh of the attacking bird. The bird let out a whistling tea-kettle scream, and its beak flashed down at the fury's head. The beak struck sparks from the stone and one of the earthen hound's ears fell off. But Brutus didn't so much as flinch. Tarvi let out a shout and swung his uncle's sword with both hands. It struck at the base of the bird's neck, and Tarvi felt the blow in his hand as the bird struggled and thrashed, a quivering sensation like that of a fish on a line. He drew back the sword and struck again. Dark blood splashed and stained the blade. Tarvi kept on swinging the sword, once dodging aside from the bird's free talon. Again and again the heavy weapon bit into the bird's body or neck. Again and again dark blood splashed up from the blade. Brutus wrenched the bird to one side and threw it to the ground with bone-crushing force. Tarvi screamed again, the blood roaring in his ears, and swung the sword at the bird's head like an axe. Tarvi heard and felt the crunch of impact, and the bird collapsed, ceasing its thrashing and its tea-kettle screams. Tarvi trembled violently. There was dark blood on his clothes and on the sword in his hands and scattered over the bird's feathers and on the ground. Brutus still held the bird's thigh in his granite jaws. A stench wafted up from the body, foul and rotten. Tarvi swallowed and felt his stomach roil. He turned away from the bird's body and toward his uncle, who lay prone on the ground. "Uncle," Tarvi said. He knelt down beside the man. There was blood on Bernard's clothes and on his hands. "Uncle Bernard!" Bernard turned his pale face up to Tarvi, his features twisted in a grimace of pain. He had both hands clamped to his thigh, squeezing until his knuckles had turned white.
"My leg," he said. "We've got to tie off my leg, boy, or I'm finished."
Tarvi swallowed and nodded. He put down the sword and unfastened his belt.
"What about Brutus?" he asked.
Bernard shook his head, a tight, small motion.
"Not yet. Can't get anything through to him like this."
Tarvi had to haul with both hands to move his uncle's leg enough to let him slip the belt around it, and doing so drew a grunt of pain from the big man. Tarvi wrapped the belt as tightly as he could and then tied it off. Bernard let out another low sound of pain and removed his hands slowly. Blood soaked his breeches, but no fresh scarlet appeared. The wound looked horrible. Muscles lay open, and Tarvi thought he caught a glimpse of white bone beneath. His stomach heaved again, and he looked away.
"Crows,"
he breathed. He was still shaking, his heart still beating too quickly.
"Uncle, are you all right?"
"Hurting pretty good. Keep talking to me until it passes a little."
Tarvi fretted at his lip.
"All right. What was that thing?"
"Herd bane. They have them further south. Feverthorn jungle mostly. Never heard of one this far north before, or that big."
"They kill for sport?"
"No. Too stupid to know when to stop. Once they scent blood, they tear apart anything that moves."
Tarvi swallowed and nodded.
"Are we in danger now?"
"Maybe. Herdbane hunt in pairs. Go look at the bird."
"What?"
"Look at the crow-eaten bird, boy," Bernard growled.
Tarvi rose to his feet and went back over to the herdbane. Its free leg twitched, the talons opening and closing spasmodically. The smell of offal surrounded him, and Tarvi held his breath, covering his nose and mouth with one hand. Bernard grunted and sat up, though his head dropped for a moment as he did, and he had to brace his hands on the ground.
"You killed it with the first blow, Tarvi. You should have stepped back and let the thing die."
"But it was still fighting," Tarvi said.
Bernard shook his head.
"You'd laid its neck open. It wasn't going to be fighting for long. Takes time to bleed to death, and until they do, they can take you with them. Look at its neck, right behind its head."
Tarvi swallowed and walked around the corpse and around Brutus as well, until he stood behind the bird's beak and looked as his uncle had directed him. Something disturbed the feathers just behind the bird's head. He knelt down and reached out with tentative fingers to brush some of the feathers away and peer at whatever it was. A circlet made out of a braid of several types of rough cloth and hide encompassed the bird's throat, denting in the muscle where it pressed.
"There's some kind of collar on it," Tavi said.
"What's it made of?"
Bernard rumbled.
"I don't know. Cloth and some leather in a braid. It doesn't look familiar."
"That's a Marat collar. We need to get out of the barrens, Tavi."
Tavi looked up, startled. "There aren't any Marat in the Calderon Valley, Uncle. The legions keep them out. There hasn't been a Marat here since they had the big battle years and years ago."
Bernard nodded.
"Before you were born. But two cohorts at garrison doesn't necessarily keep them out if they aren't coming in numbers. There's a Marat warrior up here, and he isn't going to be happy that we killed his bird. Neither is its mate."
"Mate?"
"Marks on the top of her head. Mating scars. We killed the female."
Tavi swallowed.
"Then I guess we should go."
Bernard nodded, the motion weary, unsteady.
"Come here, boy."
Tavi did, kneeling close to his uncle. One of the sheep let out a bleat, and Tavi frowned, looking up. The small flock milled around, and Dodger began to trot about, shoving them roughly back into a group with his horns.
"Brutus,"
Bernard said, his voice gruff and unsteady. He drew in a deep breath, expression becoming one of concentration.
"Let go of the bird. Take us both back home."
The stone hound dropped the bird and turned toward Bernard. Brutus sank down into the earth again. Tavi felt the patch of ground he stood on begin to quiver and move. Then, with a groan of tortured rock, a slab of stone perhaps 5 feet across rose up beneath them and began sliding southward like a raft on a slow-moving river. The earth raft drifted toward the entryway to the little clearing, slowly gathering speed. Bernard muttered,
"Just wake me up when we get back."
Then he lay down and closed his eyes, his face and body going immediately slack again. Tavi glanced at his uncle, frowning, and then back at the sheep. Dodger had them herded into the thicket again and had presented his horns, and not toward Tavi.
"Uncle Bernard?"
Tavi said, and he thought his voice sounded high-pitched and panicky.
"Uncle Bernard, I think something is coming."
Tavi's uncle did not respond. Tavi looked around for his uncle's sword, but he had left it lying beside the herdbane's body, and it was now 2 dozen strides away. Tavi clenched his hands into frustrated fists. This was all his fault. If he hadn't shirked his duties to impress Beritta, he wouldn't have needed to come looking for Dodger, and his uncle wouldn't have needed to follow him. Tavi shivered. Suddenly the possibility of death seemed very real, looming stark and close. Shadows fell over the valley, and Tavi looked up to see racing clouds darken the sun, and he heard a distant rumble of thunder. Wind made the trees and scant brush begin to sway and stir, and the earth raft seemed to crawl. Though already up to the walking pace of a man and still accelerating, Tavi found himself desperate to move faster and terrified that it might already be too late. Tavi swallowed. If something came after them now, his uncle would not be able to help him. Tavi would have to handle it alone. A high whistling screech came from the trees to the west of them, up the slope. Tavi jerked his head in that direction, but saw nothing. The screech repeated itself. Another herdbane. A second screech answered it, this time from the east of the earth raft and from unnervingly close at hand. A third? Brush rattled perhaps 50 paces back in the trees, then again, closer. Tavi thought he saw something moving toward them, closing in.
"They're coming,"
he said in a quiet voice. Tavi swallowed. Though Brutus might eventually reach the pace of a running man and hold it for hours or days, he wouldn't get there in time to help them escape. Bernard had no chance at all of evading another Herdbane as he lay unconscious, and Brutus's focus was all on bearing the pair of them back toward home. Which meant that the only way his uncle could escape was if the Herdbanes went looking somewhere else. If someone led them off in another direction. Tarvi took a deep breath, rolled off the earth raft to one side of the trail, and lay completely still. If the Herdbanes tracked movement, surely they would have more trouble with the wind rising and the trees and brush swaying in it. He would remain still for a while and then start making plenty of noise and motion to draw the hunters away from their vulnerable prey. Thunder rumbled again, and Tarvi felt a tiny cold raindrop splash on his cheek. He looked up and saw vast and dark clouds growing around the mountain. Another cold raindrop fell on him, and he felt a rush of fear that nearly forced him to empty his stomach. Fury storms could be deadly to anyone caught out in the open. Without the solid protection of the Steadholt's walls or the protection of his own furies, he would be nearly helpless before the storm. Breathing fast and light, Tarvi picked up several rocks that seemed a good size for throwing. Then he turned to the west and hurled the stone on the highest arch he could manage. The stone flew in silence and struck on a tree trunk, making a sharp sound. Tarvi pressed against the base of the tree and held still. There was a whistle from the other side of the trail, and something moved through the brush toward it. Tarvi heard steps behind him, and then a great dark form flashed past him in near silence, a bound that took it across the rough trail Brutus's passage had made. Another Herdbane, this one darker, larger than the first. It ran on its toes, though its talons rattled against fallen pine needles, and its feathers brushed through the limbs of the evergreens. It went toward the spot where the stone had landed, vanishing back into the brush. Tarvi let out a breath. He threw another stone, farther away, back toward the clearing, rather than in the direction where Brutus was slowly bearing his uncle to safety. Then he crouched low and headed back toward the clearing himself, tossing a new stone every few paces. The wind kept rising, and more tiny, stinging droplets of near-frozen rain began to fall. Tarvi labored to keep his breathing as silent as he could and crept back to the clearing, quiet as a cat, creeping the last few paces on his belly under the overhanging branches of one of the evergreens. The sheep were nowhere to be seen. But the second Herdbane was already there. So was the Marat. This Herdbane stood at least a head taller than the first, and its feathers were darker, its eyes a browner shade of gold. It stood over the corpse of the bird Tarvi had killed, one leg cocked up underneath its body, leaning its neck down to nuzzle its beak against its dead mate's feathers. The Marat was the first Tarvi had seen. He was tall, taller than anyone Tarvi knew. He looked not unlike a man, but his shoulders were very broad, and his body heavy with flat, swift-looking muscle. He wore only a cloth around his hips, though that seemed mostly utilitarian, worn only to provide a belt to hang several pouches from, and from which depended something that looked like a dagger made of black glass. His hair was long and thick and looked sickly white in the dim grey light that shone through the rain clouds. He had tied dark feathers into his hair here and there, and they lent him a savage aspect. The Marat moved to the Herdbane's body and knelt over it, reaching out to lay both wide, powerful-looking hands upon the beast. He let out a soft keening sound, which was echoed by the male beside him, and both went still for a moment, bowing their heads. Then the man snarled, splitting his lips apart, and his head turned this way and that, looking around him, white teeth bared. His eyes, Tarvi saw, were precisely the same shade of gold as the Herdbane's, inhuman and bright. Tarvi remained where he was, hardly daring to breathe. The Marat's features were not difficult to read. He was furious. And as the man turned his head in a slow circle around the clearing, Tarvi saw that his teeth and his hands were stained with scarlet blood. The Marat stood and held a hand to his mouth. He took a breath and blew, a wailing whistle flying from his lips, loud enough to make Tavi wince. He blew a short sequence, the notes higher and lower, long and short. Then he fell silent. Tavi's brow furrowed into a frown, and he dropped his jaw a little, half closing his eyes, and listened. After a time there came, half mangled by the rising winds, a whistling answer. Tavi had no way of knowing what the answer said, but that there was an answer in itself was frightening enough. The whistling communication could mean only one thing. There were more than one of the barbarians here. The Marat had returned to Calderon Valley. Perhaps they were simply hunting, taking refuge from detection in the humanity-free area in the pine barrens around Garados. Or perhaps, Tavi's panicked thoughts ran, they were the advanced scouts for a horde. But that seemed mad. A horde hadn't been seen in more than 15 years, not since before Tavi was born. And while they had enjoyed a brief spate of victory, destroying the Crown Legion and slaying the Princeps Gaius, the Alaran Legions had crushed the Horde only weeks later, dealing them such a deadly stroke that everyone had assumed that the Marat would never return. Tavi swallowed. But they had returned. And if they meant to return in force, the Marat in the valley were probably advance scouts. If they were, they would never let one rather skinny and undersized boy who had seen them escape to warn others of their presence. The Marat returned to glaring around the clearing. He seized several feathers and jerked them out of the dead herdbane, then reached up and tied them to strands of his hair. He made a whistling sound at the living herdbane, moving one hand in a gesture. The bird responded by moving in that direction in long, stalking steps, its eyes sweeping back and forth. The Marat, meanwhile, dropped down to all fours. He sniffed at the blood on the fallen herdbane's claws, and then, to Tavi's disgust, leaned down and ran his tongue along it. Then he closed his mouth with his eyes narrowed, tasting the blood as though it were a wine. The Marat opened his eyes again, remained low on all fours, and began casting around the floor of the clearing like a dog after a scent. He paused at the fallen sword and picked it up, staring down at the weapon stained with the herdbane's blood. Then he lowered the blade to wipe it clean on the grass of the clearing and slipped it through his cloth belt. The wind continued to rise and change directions at every breath. Tavi felt it brush against his back. He froze in place, sure that if he moved he would be immediately seen. The Marat jerked his head up, abruptly turning to look directly at Tavi's hiding place. The boy swallowed, tensing in fear. The Marat let out another whistle and made a hand signal. The herdbane stalked toward Tavi's hiding place. Just like a chicken after a bug, Tavi thought, and I'm the bug. But a few steps later, the herdbane let out a shriek, turning to face south. The Marat followed the herdbane, golden eyes reading the signs of passage in the earth. He crouched down, nostrils flaring, and looked up with a sudden eager light in his eyes. The Marat rose and began to stalk southward after Tavi's wounded uncle. "No!" Tavi shouted. He threw himself to his feet and out of his hiding place, hurling one of his remaining stones at the Marat. His aim proved true. The rock struck the Marat high on the cheek, and blood welled from the gash. The Marat stared at Tavi with those golden bird-of-prey eyes and snarled something in a tongue Tavi could not understand. His intentions, though, were clear, even before he drew the glass dagger from his belt. His eyes burned with anger. The Marat let out a whistle, and the herdbane whirled toward him. Then he pointed at Tavi and let out that same whistling tea-kettle battle cry the dead bird had used. Tavi turned and ran. He had run from those larger and stronger than him for the whole of his young life. Most games at the Steadholt involved chasing of one kind or another, and Tavi had learned how to make his small size and quickness work for him. He ran through the densest thickets of bracken he could find, and slipped through mazes of thorns, windfalls, sinkholes, and young evergreens. The wind grew stronger, filling the air with fallen pine needles and dust. Tavi ran west to lead them away from his uncle. The eerie wailing of the herdbane and its master raced after him, but fear gave his feet wings. The boy's heart pounded like a smith's hammer, heavy and swift. He knew that he was alone and that no one would come to help him. He had to rely on his own wits and experience, and should he falter or slow, the pursuing Marat and herdbane would have him. Sunset was drawing near, and the vast storm building over Garados had begun to spread over the valley. Should the Marat, the storm, or the darkness catch him unprotected in the open, he would die. Tavi ran for his life. Chapter 6. When twilight fell, Amara remained at liberty. Her body ached to her bones. The first swift rush of flight had taken the strength from her, and the second, steadier flight would have been impossible without a fortunate breeze blowing north and east in the direction she fled. She was able to use the prevailing currents of wind to assist Cirrus, and thus to conserve much of her own energy. Amara kept low, at the tops of the trees almost, and although they swayed and danced at the passage of the miniature cyclone that kept her aloft, she was better off flying low, where the terrain might help hide her passage from the eyes of the night's heiress pursuing her. The last rust-colored light of sunset showed her a sparkle of water, a winding ribbon running through the rolling wooded hills, the River Gaul. It taxed her remaining reserves to guide Cirrus to bring her in for a gentle landing, and took even more of an effort to remain on her feet after the tension of flight left her. She felt like crawling into a hollow tree and sleeping for a week. Instead, she reached down to her tattered dress, tore at the hem on one side, and from it withdrew a small disc of bright copper. "River Gaul," she whispered, pushing whatever reserves she had left into the effort to speak to the water furies. "Know this coin and hasten word to thy master." She dropped the coin, giving it a slight spin, and the image of the First Lord's profile spun and tumbled, alternating with the image of the sun in the bloody light. Amara slumped down then by the water, reaching out to cup her hands in it. Long runs were not as draining as an hour of flight, even on a good day for it. She had been fortunate. If the winds had been different, she would not have been able to escape to the Gaul. She stared down at her faint reflection and shivered for a moment. She thought of the water writhing its way up her hands, down her nose and throat, and her heart flooded with sickly fear. She struggled to force it away, but it wouldn't leave her. She could not make herself touch the water. The Water Witch could have killed her. Amara could have died right there. She hadn't. She had survived, but even so it was all she could do to keep from cowering back on the bank. She closed her eyes for a moment and tried to force the image of the woman's laughter out of her head. The men who had been chasing her presented no special fear. If she was captured by them, she would be killed with bright steel, perhaps brutalized, but all of that she had prepared herself for. She thought of the smile on Odiana's face as her water fury had smothered Amara, drowning her on dry land. There had been an almost childish, unrestrained glee in the woman's eyes. Amara shuddered. Nothing had prepared her for that. And yet she had to face that terror. She had to embrace it. Her duty required her to do no less. She thrust her hands into the cold water of the river. The young cursor splashed water onto her face and made an abortive attempt to comb her hair with her fingers. Even though she wore it shorter than was customary, barely to her shoulders, and even though her hair was straight and fine, a tawny brown gold, still, a few hours in gale winds had tangled it into knots and made her look like a particularly shaggy mongrel dog. She eyed her reflection again. Thin, harsh features, she thought, though with the proper cosmetics she could whittle them down to merely severe. Listless hair, cobwebby and delicate, and currently as tousled as a haystack. Her face and arms beneath the grime were tanned as dark as her hair, giving her a monochromatic look in the water, like a statue carved of pale wood and then lightly stained. Her simple clothes were tattered, frayed at the edges from hours in the wind, and thickly stained with mud and spatters of dark brown that must have been blood around the slice in her blouse, where her arm throbbed with dull pain. The water stirred, and a fury-crafted form rose out of it, but instead of the First Lord, a woman took shape. Gaius Caria, wife to Gaius Sextus, Alera's First Lord, seemed young, hardly older than Amara herself. She wore a splendid high-waisted gown, her hair coiffed into an intricate series of braids, with a few artful curls falling to frame her face. The woman was beautiful, but more than that, she carried with her a sense of serenity, of purpose, of grace, and of power. Amara abruptly felt like a gangling cow and dropped into a curtsy as best she could, hands taking the soiled skirts and holding to them.
"Your Grace."
"Academ," murmured the woman in reply. "Not 20 days have passed since my husband gave you his coin, and already you interrupt his supper. I believe that is a new record. Fidelius, I am told, did not see fit to drag him from his meal or his bed until at least a month had gone by." Amara felt her face flush with heat.
"Yes, Your Grace, I apologize for the necessity."
The First Lady gave her an arch look, up and down the grimy length of her body. Amara felt her blush deepen, and she fought not to squirm.
"No apology is necessary," Lady Caria said. "Though you might work on your timing in the future."
"Yes, Lady. Please, Your Grace, I need to speak to the First Lord."
Lady Caria shook her head.
"Impossible," she said, her tone one of finality. "I'm afraid you'll have to speak to him later, perhaps tomorrow."
"But, Lady, he's..."
"Swamped," the First Lady said, emphasizing each syllable.
"If you feel the matter is an important one, Academ, then you may leave me a message and I will present it to him as soon as opportunity allows."
"Please forgive me, Lady, but I was told that if I ever used the coin, that the message was to be only for him."
"Mind your tongue, Academ," Caria said, her brows arched. "Remember to whom you speak."
"I have the orders from the First Lord himself, Your Grace. I only attempt to obey them."
"Admirable. But the First Lord is not a favorite professor you can simply visit yourself upon whenever you wish, Academ."
She stressed the last word very slightly.
"And he has affairs of state to attend to."
Amara swallowed and said, "Your Grace, please, I will not be long in telling him. Let him judge if I am abusing the privilege. Please."
"No,"
Caria said. The sculpted figure looked over its shoulder.
"You have taken enough of my time, Academ Amara."
The First Lady's voice gained a note of tension.
"Hurry."
"If that is all..."
Amara licked her lips. If she could hold on a moment more, perhaps the First Lord would overhear the conversation.
"Your Grace, before you go, may I give you a message to pass on to him?"
"Be quick."
"Yes, Your Grace. If you would only tell him that..."
Amara didn't get any farther than that before the watery form of the First Lady grimaced and shot her a cool glance, her features becoming remote and hard. The water beside Lady Caria stirred, and a second fury-crafted shape rose from it. This one was a man, tall, with shoulders that had once been broad, but were now slumped with age. He carried himself with a casual pride and a confidence that showed in every line of his body. The water figure did not appear in liquid translucence, as did Lady Caria's. It rose from the river in full color, and Amara thought for just a moment that the First Lord himself had somehow come, rather than sending a fury in his place. His hair was dark, streaked with silver-white strands, and his green eyes looked faded, weary, and confident.
"Hear now," said the figure in a gentle ringing bass, "what passes, my wife?"
The figure of Gaius turned toward Amara, squinting. His features went completely still for a moment. Then he murmured,
"Ah, I see. Greetings, Cursor."
Lady Caria shot her husband's image a glance at the use of that title, and then her remote gaze returned to Amara.
"This one wished to speak with you, but I had informed her that you had a state dinner to attend."
"Your Majesty," Amara murmured, and curtsied again.
Gaius let out a sigh and waved a hand vaguely.
"You go ahead, my wife. I'll be along shortly."
Lady Caria's chin lifted, tilting with a sharp little motion.
"Husband, there will be considerable consternation if we do not arrive together."
Gaius turned his face toward Lady Caria.
"Then if it pleases you, wife, you may wait elsewhere for me."
The First Lady pressed her lips together but gave a graceful, proper nod before her image abruptly fell back into the water, creating a splash that drenched Amara to the waist. The girl let out a surprised cry, moving to wipe uselessly at her skirts.
"Oh, my lord, please excuse me."
Gaius made a tisking sound, and his image moved a hand. The water fled from the cloth of her skirts, simply pattered out onto the ground in a steady rain of orderly droplets that gathered into a small muddy puddle and then flowed back down into the river, leaving her skirts, at least, quite clean.
"Please excuse the First Lady," Gaius murmured. "These last 3 years have not been kind to her."
3 years since she married you, my lord," Amara thought. But aloud she said only, "Yes, your majesty."
The First Lord inhaled, then nodded, the expression brusque. He had shaved his beard since Amara had seen him last, and the lines of age, faint on the mostly youthful features, showed as dark shadows at the corners of his eyes and mouth. Gaius appeared to be a hale 40 years of age. In fact, Amara knew that he was twice that, and that no silver had been showing in his hair when she arrived at the Royal Academy 5 years before.
"Your report," Gaius said. "Let's hear it."
"Yes, my lord. As you instructed, Fidelius and I attempted to infiltrate the suspected revolutionary camp. We were successful in getting inside."
She felt her mouth go dry, and she swallowed.
But he..."
Gaius nodded, his expression grave.
"But he betrayed you. He proved to be more interested in serving the cause of the insurrectionists than in remaining loyal to his lord."
Amara blinked up at him, startled. "Yes, my lord. But how did you..."
Gaius shrugged.
"I didn't. But I suspected. When you reach my age, Amara, people show themselves to you very clearly. They write their intentions and beliefs through their actions, their lies."
He shook his head.
"I saw the signs in Fidelius when he was only a little older than you. But that seed has picked a particularly vicious moment to bloom."
"You suspected?" Amara asked. "But you told me nothing?"
"Could you have kept it from him? Could you have played that kind of charade with him who taught you for the duration of the mission?"
Amara clenched her teeth rather than speak in anger.
Gaius was right. She never would have been able to keep such knowledge from Fidelius. "Why did you send me?"
Her words came out clipped, precise.
Gaius gave her a weary smile. "Because you are the fastest cursor I have ever seen. Because you were a brilliant student at the academy. Resourceful, stubborn, and able to think on your feet. Because Fidelius liked you. And because I was sure of your loyalty."
"Bait," Amara said, her words still with hard edges, points. "You used me as bait. You knew he wouldn't be able to resist trying to bring me with him. Recruit me."
"Essentially correct."
"You would have sacrificed me."
"If you hadn't come back, I would know that you had failed in your mission, probably because of Fidelius. Either that, or you would have cast your lot with the insurgents. Either way, I would be sure of the color of Fidelius's cloak."
"Which was the point of the exercise?"
"Hardly. I needed the intelligence as well."
"So you risked my life to get it?"
Gaius nodded.
"Yes, cursor. You swore your life to the service of the crown, did you not?"
Amara looked down, her face colouring, anger and confusion and disappointment piling up in her belly.
Yes, my lord.
Then report. I do have to be at a dinner shortly.
Amara took a breath, and without looking up, she recounted the events of the day, what she and Fidelius had seen, what she knew about the insurgent legion, and especially of the strength and estimated numbers of the knights accompanying it. She looked up at the end of her report. Gaius's face looked older, the lines deeper somehow, as though her words to him had drained out a little more of his life, his youth, his strength.
The note. The one you were allowed to read, Gaius began.
A diversion, my lord, I know. An attempt to cast suspicion elsewhere. I do not believe Lord Atticus to have a hand in this.
Perhaps. But remember that the note was addressed to the commander of the Second Legion.
Gaius shook his head.
That would seem to indicate that more than one of the High Lords is conspiring against me. This may be the effort of one to ensure that the blame for the entire matter falls on the other.
Assuming there are only two, my lord.
Gaius's eyes wrinkled further at the corners.
Yes. Assuming all of them aren't in it together, eh?
The brief smile faded.
And that they wished details of my inner chambers from you seems to indicate that they believe they could accomplish an assassination, and so take power directly.
Surely not, my lord. They could not kill you.
Gaius shrugged.
Not if I saw it coming. But the power to shake mountains does little good if the knife is already buried in one's throat.
He grimaced.
One of the younger High Lords. It must be. Anyone of any age would simply use time as his assassin. I'm an old man.
No, Your Majesty. You are
an old man. An old man married to a willful and politically convenient child. An old man who rarely sleeps at night and who needs to be on time to dinner.
He eyed Amara up and down and said,
Night is falling. Are you in condition to travel?
I believe so, my lord.
Gaius nodded.
Events are stirring all over Alera. I can feel it in my bones, girl. The march of feet, the restless migration of beasts. Already the behemoths sing in the darkness off the western coast, and the wild furies of the north country are preparing a cold winter this year. A cold winter.
The First Lord drew in a breath and closed his eyes.
And voices speak loudly. Tension gathers in one place. The furies of earth and air and wood whisper everywhere that something dangerous is abroad and that the peace our land has enjoyed these past 15 years nears its end. Metal furies hone the edges of swords and startle smiths at the forge. The rivers and the rains wait for when they shall run red with blood, and fire itself burns green of a night or blue rather than in scarlet and gold. Change is coming.
Amara swallowed. Perhaps they are only coincidences, my lord. They may not be...
Gaius smiled again, but the expression was skeletal, wasted.
I'm not that old, Amara. Not yet. And I have work for you. Attend.
Amara nodded and focused on the image.
Are you familiar with the significance of the Calderon Valley?
Amara nodded once.
It lies just over the isthmus, between Alera and the plains beyond. There is only one pass through the mountains, and it runs through the valley. If anyone wants to come into our lands afoot, they must come through Calderon Valley.
Anyone meaning the Marat, of course, Gaius said. What else do you know of the place?
What they taught at the academy, my lord. Very fertile land, profitable. And it was where the Marat killed your son, my lord.
Yes. The Marat Horde Master. He killed the princeps and set a chain of events into motion that will clutter the lecture halls and plague the students for a century to come. The House of Gaius has led Alera for nearly 1,000 years. But when I am gone, that will be done. All that is left to me is to see to it that the power falls into responsible hands.
and it would seem that someone seeks to make that choice in my stead.
Do you know who, my lord?
Suspicions, Gaius said. But I dare not voice more than that, lest I accuse an innocent man and lose the support of the High Lords altogether, loyal and insurgent alike. You will go to the Calderon Valley, Amara. The Maratha on the move. I know it. I feel it.
What do you wish me to do there, my lord?
You will observe the movements of any Marat in the area, Gaius said, and speak to the steadholders there, to learn what passes.
Amara tilted her head to one side. You suspect that the Marat and the recent insurgent activity are related, my lord?
The Marat are easily made into tools, Amara, and I suspect that someone has forged a dagger of them to thrust at my heart.
His eyes flashed, and the river rippled around the feet of the water image in reaction to the emotion.
I may pass on my power to someone of worth, but while I live and breathe, they will not take it from me.
Yes, my lord. Gaius gave her a grim smile.
If you should stumble over some connection between the two, Amara, bring it to me. If I had a scrap of proof to lay before the High Lords, I could settle this without needless bloodshed.
As you wish, my lord. I will go there as swiftly as I am able.
Tonight, Gaius said.
Amara shook her head. I'm not sure I can do that, Majesty. I'm exhausted.
Gaius nodded. I will speak to the South Wind. It will help you get there more quickly.
Amara swallowed. What am I to look for, my lord? Do you have any suspicions? If I know what to be on watch for...
Gaius said no. I need your eyes open and unprejudiced. Get to the valley. It is where events are centering. I want you representing my interests in them.
Am I likely to face near certain death again, my lord? Amara let just a hint of barb slide into the words. Gaius tilted his head.
Almost certainly, Cursor. Do you wish me to send another in your place?
Amara shook her head. I wish for you to answer a question. Gaius lifted his eyebrows.
What is your question?
Amara looked steadily at Gaius's image. How did you know, my lord? How did you know I would remain true to the crown? Gaius frowned, more lines appearing on his face. He remained silent for a long moment before he said,
There are some people who will never understand what loyalty means. They could tell you what it was, of course, but they will never know. They will never see it from the inside. They couldn't imagine a world where something like that was real.
Like Fidelius.
Like Fidelius, Gaius agreed. You're a rare person, though, Amara. You're just the opposite.
She frowned. You mean I know what loyalty is?
More than that. You live within it. You couldn't imagine a world in which you didn't. You could no more betray what you held dear than you could will your heart to stop beating. I'm old, Amara, and people reveal themselves to me.
He was quiet for a moment more and said,
I never doubted your loyalty. Only your ability to survive the mission. And it appears that I may owe you an apology on that count, Cursor Amara. Consider your graduation exercise a success.
Amara felt pride stir in her, an absurd feeling of pleasure that Gaius would praise her so. She felt her back straighten and her chin lift a little higher. I am your eyes and ears to command, my lord. Gaius nodded once, and behind Amara the wind began to rise, rustling over the trees like surf over sand, making them whisper and sigh in a vast, quiet chorus.
Go with the Furies, then, Cursor. For Alera.
I will find what you need, Your Majesty. For Alera. Chapter 7. Fidelius hated flying. He sat on the litter facing ahead so that the wind sliced into his eyes and blew his hair straight back from his high forehead. On the seat facing him sat Aldric the Sword,
huge and relaxed as a newly fed lion. Odiana had curled up on Aldric's lap to doze off hours before, and the Water Witch's dark hair danced and played in the wind, veiling the beauty of her features. Neither one evinced any signs of discomfort at the flight, physical or otherwise.
"I hate flying,"